Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund intelligence. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our U.S. Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, great to be with you. What are we going to talk about today?
Great to be here. I know that we're well into Q2, but one thing that we wanted to cover and that is part of our regular cadence is recapping some of the insights and updates that we heard from the REITs and other real estate firms as they closed out Q1 and reported on their Q1 results. This is something that we know it might not be incredibly timely since you're probably listening to this in June. But that being said, taking stock of what happened through the first quarter of the year, as well as hearing what the management teams are focused on when they are presenting the results from the first quarter is, I think, always an insightful check-in and is part of our regular process.
And I think Nareit's REIT week is wrapping up as we're recording this. So these are probably some topics that are on a lot of folks' minds. So I think it's important to go through these and see what we've got going on.
Absolutely.
So how about we jump right in? I think let's start with industrial. What did you cover this time?
Sure. So kicking off REIT earnings is Prologis. So they tend to be one of the very first large REITs to report. They reported on April 16th. If you're not familiar with Prologis, I would encourage you to look them up.
But I hope most of our listeners are.
Yeah, I hope so. But ultimately, they are the largest industrial REIT. They own and develop industrial, which is pretty much largely distribution centers. But that being said, they're starting to dip a toe into data centers as well. Their portfolio consists of about 1.3 billion square feet across 20 countries. So they really have this huge presence as well as a great global perspective. But first, let's hit on some of the results that they reported. Overall, it was pretty strong Q1 growth. Revenue was $2.14 billion. That's up about 9% year on year. And this was driven by higher rents and occupancy. Net earnings per share were 63 cents per share. That's about flat with the Q1 2024. Core FFO, or funds from operation per share, came in at $1.42. That's up about 10 to 11% year on year, reflecting really robust rent growth. And then cash same store NOI rose 6.2% in the quarter, and that's on a year on year basis. So overall, just very impressive financial results. The earnings beat really helped drive a positive, like, reaction of their shares. So shares climbed about 2% on the report of their earnings. In terms of operational highlights, average occupancy held in the high 94. The exact number was 94.8%. So you can still see a lot of demand there. And Prologis signed 65.1 million square feet of leases in Q1. That's roughly 25% more space leased than a year ago. Rent spreads were exceptional, with cash rent change up 32% and net effective rents up over 50% on rollovers. This really underscores that the strong demand and limited new supply. Really, that's a theme that the management team continued to articulate through the call. So same store NOI was up 6.2% year on year. I know I'm repeating that, but that is, I think, a pretty still impressive comparison to prior periods. So even though we have heard some slowdown or some challenges in the industrial space, I think their portfolio continues to really be a strong performer. Turning to the management commentary of the call, the management team was really focused on the strong results, which they called, quote, exceptional results amid this cautious macro backdrop. And the CEO ultimately acknowledge that there is some near-term customer caution, but express that there's still some very strong long-term fundamentals in play. The management team reaffirmed their 2025 guidance with core FFO in the range of $5.65 to $5.81 per share. And net earnings guidance ultimately also remained the same at $3.45 to $3.70 per share. Again, reaffirming the fundamentals of the portfolio, occupancy for 2025 is still expected in that kind of mid-94% range. One thing that they did change on this call was that the management team did trim their development pipeline forecast, really lowering expected 2025 development starts and dispositions, and noted that this really is reflecting a more measured growth pace. Now, overall, management still has this positive long-term outlook, citing resilient demand and the company's capacity to really quickly move on any sort of opportunities that emerge. Because they were going pretty early on, and I'll remind that they were reporting on April 16th, this was shortly after or right in the first inning of tariff turmoil, which was really rocking the markets. And so that's something that I think pretty much all management teams, whether you're looking across the REITs or other sectors that were reporting, the financials were reporting a bit before. And these were challenging times for management teams to really address because the changes had just happened. And ultimately, there wasn't too much data for them to share any additional insights on. So there were a few questions that came up in the call, but they weren't necessarily able to address it at that time. But if we fast forward to a little bit more present and earlier this week, at least because we're recording the start of June, the Prologis team also did speak at Nareit's REIT Week, which is a large REIT conference that takes place here in New York. And during that presentation and conversation with an analyst, the team really reiterated the major theme of demand still being in place. E-commerce remains a structural tailwind, which they highlighted that e-commerce tends to use three times more space than traditional retail. And so long as the e-commerce is gaining kind of market share of how consumers consume, that remains a strength for the industrial space. They did also note that on the demand side, activity did dip pre-2024 election results due to uncertainty, but then rebounded in Q4 at the end of the year. And if they're looking at the more recent tariff turmoil or trade talks and the implications there, the tariff and trade negotiations have slowed decision-making amongst globally oriented tenants, which for Prologis, that's about 15% of their customer base, though interest remains strong. And the management team also mentioned that the current environment is, quote, better than feared. And a final note from Prologis coming out of REIT Week is that they did share a bit more about their data center expansion. So they do have a long-term 10 gigawatt pipeline with about 1.4 gigawatts secured and 2 gigawatts in late stage development. Transitioning logistics properties and land to higher value data center uses is part of their overall strategy. I know I covered on a bit of the earnings and a bit of the more recent commentary coming from the management team, but did any of that ring a bell when you were listening to Rexford?
Yeah, absolutely. And so what's interesting about Rexford's call, too, is it usually lags Prologis by a day or two. And so they come in quick succession. But that also means that there wasn't a ton of commentary or they weren't able to comment a lot on some of the kind of post-Liberation Day tariff turmoil. But as a reminder, Rexford is a bit more focused, a bit of a different company. They're a Southern California-focused industrial REIT. They have about 400 properties, 50 million rentable square feet. but it's mostly infill in Southern California and your growth, population growth centers. You could think of them as not really competing against a lot of the new large supply. They're very concentrated in some of these smaller properties near these population centers where developing is not easy or impossible. So by count, about 70% of their properties are in the LA area, 12% in Riverside, San Bernardino, near the Inland Empire. And the rest are in the San Diego area, but not too many of those. Their tenant base is pretty diverse, a bit different than Prologis, I would say. A lot of third-party logistics providers, but also some domestic manufacturers, aerospace, and even some large retailers. So they announced their Q1 results on April 17th, I think just a day after Prologis' call. They actually beat consensus estimates on every top-line metric, including revenue and FFO. There were a lot of drivers for this. They had a fairly strong quarter in Q1 at 2.4 million square feet leased, a net effective rent spreads of 24%. Embedded rent steps averaged 3.6%, but they did mention this was actually slightly down sequentially. Out same property occupancy was 95.7%. And while they do expect this to dip mid-year post potential tariff turmoil, they think it'll recover by the fourth quarter. Tenant retention was 82%. They said that was their highest in more than a year. Portfolio market rents were actually down 2.8% on the quarter and 9.4% on the year, but they did outperform the broader markets in that sense. And this is data from CBRE that they cited, but in which it was down 4.7% quarter over quarter and 12.1% year over year. I thought this was interesting considering some of the stuff we've already talked about, but they said their larger spaces are facing a lot more pressure. So larger spaces to them is 100,000 square feet and above. Then their smaller spaces, which are extremely resilient, those are less than 50,000. So despite all of this and a pretty good quarter, their share price did underperform the broader REIT index after the call by 1.57%. That's largely because they revised their 2025 guidance for FFO downward by between 8 and 10%. Now, management commentary here was pretty interesting. Of course, with recent tariff announcements, at least less than 2 weeks following, shortly a little bit more than 2 weeks after the Liberation Day tariff announcement, they said that some tenants were beginning to delay decisions. So their active leasing engagement was around 90% of their vacant space leading up to the start of the year, but it dropped to 80% by April. Some other interesting things that they talked about on the call, they were able to stabilize 5 repositioning projects that were a total of 560,000 square feet, 7.6% unlevered yield, and incremental returns of 20%. They sold 2 assets during the quarter for $103 million at 4% exit caps, which I thought was incredible considering the circumstances. They have $30 million more in dispositions under contract. And I think the broad message here is that they very strongly believe that their portfolio is recession resilient, not necessarily recession proof, because they're very concentrated in last mile logistics. They don't feel that they have a lot of competition in some of these population centers. And so this was overall a fairly positive call, I would say. But definitely some similarities with Prologis, though. This is a very specific large industrial market. They like to brag on the call that the Southern California industrial market, I think, is the 4th largest in the world. And obviously, it's very import tied, but they seem to have carved out a niche here that's done fairly strong in the last few years. So a lot of talk about industrial. How about we hop over to office? I'll get us kicked off here. This is a company that I've covered a few times on the call, Cousins. So they are a Class A office REIT focused on high growth markets in the Sun Belt. So Austin, Charlotte, Atlanta, to name a few of them, but also some of the other Texas metros, Houston, Dallas. They have more than 20 million square feet across just 44 properties. So these are very large office properties. Their largest tenants are all fairly familiar names: Google, Amazon, Bank of America, Deloitte, BlackRock, Expedia, Exxon. Very large tenants with good credit, effectively. But they announced their results on May 2nd. They beat consensus estimates for both revenue and for FFO. some of the drivers behind the results. 548,000 square feet leased in the first quarter. 68% were net new. 32% were renewals. They are heavily focused on shorter leases, which I thought is super interesting compared to if you just think about some of the tenants that they have and the type of office that they own. Shorter leases are not what you typically see for this stuff. And so the average lease that they got signed during the quarter was 4.5 years, down from 5.7 in Q4. Now, same property occupancy, 91.5%. That's up from 90.6 in the fourth quarter. They currently have $320 million in active developments underway in Austin and Charlotte. And they were happy to report that 80% of that space is actually pre-leased. Now, the market really liked this call, outperformed the benchmark on May 2nd by 3.43%. There was some really interesting management commentary here. They have no acquisitions planned in the near future. They're totally focused on stabilizing their existing assets. If you tuned into the call from covering the fourth quarter results, you might remember that they made a huge splash by purchasing the Sail Tower in Austin, one of their biggest acquisitions to date. And so the fact that they don't have anything under consideration now, I think, is noteworthy. They do have $100 million planned in dispositions of non-core assets in 2025. They have some upcoming debt maturities in 2026 and 2027 that they're focused on. But I think more broadly, what I like about this call is that they talk about the Sunbelt office trends. So Sunbelt is still outperforming the coastal peers, but leasing velocity is extremely lumpy. And that's their quote, not mine. So the tenants that they're speaking with want much smaller spaces. They want them in trophy assets. They're affirming that the flight to quality is real. And I thought this was interesting, too. They do not expect office sale transaction activity to be strong in the first half of 2025 at all because of uncertainty around interest rates. So they're, I think, projecting about their own acquisition activity here, but they don't expect overall activity to be very strong. And I actually thought that was interesting considering we just released our ITQ report showing that it was slightly up on the year in the first quarter. So I'll be interested to see what the second looks like. And lastly, they mentioned a little about construction costs. They said that as construction costs are still rising, but inflation is slowing a bit for now. If you look at when this call was, May 2nd, I think we've had some recent announcements about a lot of construction tariffs on construction inputs, aluminum, steel, others, and in the last few weeks. So this commentary might change a little bit next quarter. But Omar, what office REIT did you cover?
Yeah, so I covered BXP, which reported on April 30th, so only a few days before Cousins. BXP develops, owns, and manages premier workspace across the U.S., but are heavily concentrated in six major metros: Boston, L.A., New York, SF, or San Francisco, Seattle, and D.C. They have about 53 million square feet across 185 properties and moderately robust development pipeline, which has about 9 additional properties. But in terms of their Q1 results, revenue was $865 million. That's up about 3% year on year as newly leased space and rent escalations offset some of the headwinds that the REIT faces. And net income fell in the first quarter from a year ago at about $61 million or 39 cents EPS. That's from $79.9 million a year ago. Part of this decline in net income had to do with higher interest expense and vacancies across their portfolio. FFO came in at $1.64 per share. This is down from $1.73, or about 5% down from a year ago. And the drop in FFO really is reflecting some softer same property performance and the higher financing costs, which I previously mentioned. Overall, the results were generally in line with analyst expectations going into the call, particularly on FFO. Revenue was slightly up And ultimately, the share price reaction following the call was a bit negative. However, I think that was largely driven by concerns in the office sector as a whole. Shares fell about 3.5% after earnings and then dipped an additional 3.5% after hours trading after they had reported. If we turn back to the call itself and look at some of the operational highlights from the first quarter, for the portfolio's occupancy ended the first quarter at 86.9%. This is reflecting a previously known large move out, which was about 350,000 square feet of lease expiring in New York. And so that pulled down occupancy by about 60 basis points. However, BXP already backfilled a majority of that space with a new 244,000 square foot lease. This property in question is 205th Avenue in New York. The management team also noted that leasing volume was a bright spot in the first quarter. BXP executed 91 leases totaling 1.1 million square feet through the quarter. That's a 25% increase in leasing volume year on year, so compared to the first quarter of 24. And also on the call, BXP noted that they have been proactively strengthening their balance sheet. They completed a $4.2 billion financing in Q1, and that included a mix of secured debt and bank facilities. I think liquidity amongst office REITs has been a particular area of focus by analysts for the last couple of years. So BXP had previously trimmed their dividend in 2023 to conserve cash, but this recent refinancing is an extension of how that management team is addressing those liquidity and capital concerns. In the management commentary portion of the call, the management team noted that while the office market conditions are challenging, the premier properties or higher quality properties that make up BXP's portfolio and their position in gateway cities really is actually a strength, and they're continuing to see their properties attract tenants. They noted that leasing momentum is strong, and that the company is currently focusing on executing 4 million square feet of leasing through 2025. So that was a goal that they had previously set, but that they are making progress on that. The team is also very much focused on controlling expenses amid rising operating costs. And in terms of guidance, the management team maintained their full year outlook, but did narrow their guidance range. So for 2025, BXP is guiding FFO to be between $6.80 to $6.92 per share. This would reflect a modest decline of about 2 to 3% versus 2024's FFO. The company also expects occupancy to stabilize and begin improving in 2026 as new leases commence. And specifically around the next quarter, or I guess the current quarter that we're in, but the next quarter that they're reporting, for Q2 2025, guidance was set at FFO of $1.65 to $1.67 per share. This is roughly flat with the first quarter's results. One other thing, so because they reported in April, they did also present at REIT Week. And I'd say there are two main themes that popped up during that session. The first was really the major bifurcation and flight to quality that's being seen in the office space. They noted that premier buildings have vacancy rates of about 5 percentage points lower than non-premier. Their asking rents for premier tend to be about 50% higher, and there's net positive absorption for premier or high quality properties as opposed to net negative for the lower end. So I think that this is something that has been playing out, but that being said, I think the additional color and commentary and the specific numbers I think are worth noting. The other big thing that came out of that conversation was the development versus acquisition model. And this is something that you just touched on, Cole, with Cousins. And in the conversation, the BXP team noted they're seeing development yields 8% and above, which is really meaningfully exceeding acquisition cap rates in that mid-5 range. And so I think it's an interesting point in time where the office sector has quite a few headwinds from the demand dynamic, but if you can hit the right segment of the market.
And I think in the markets that BXP is in, it's incredibly difficult to develop.
Absolutely.
Cousins, on the other hand, in the Sun Belt, where it's a lot easier to build, I can totally see where the kind of flight to quality trends are benefiting BXP.
Yeah, which I think these are not easy projects to do, but that being said, they appear to pencil. And they did note that their 343 Madison project is really exemplifying that, where they are targeting about $200 per square foot average rents with 8% development yields versus any sort of acquired or potential acquisition asset, which is trading at much lower returns. I thought that was super interesting on that office front. But if we turn attention and leave the office space and go to retail, the retail REIT that I covered for this quarter is Simon Property Group. So they reported on May 12th. The company owns, develops, and manages shopping and entertainment properties. They have about 230 properties comprising nearly 185 million square feet across North America, Asia, and Europe. They also own an 88% interest in the Taubman Realty Group, which owns an additional 22 regional malls and outlet malls across the U.S. and Asia. So first, looking at their results, revenue came in at $1.47 billion for Q1. This is about a 2% increase year on year compared to the first quarter of 24. Net income was $413.7 million, or EPS was about $1.27 per share. This is sharply down from the $731 million, or $2.25 per share EPS in Q1 of 24, but this is due to one-time items. So last year's quarter included large gains from asset sales. This year's had a small mark-to-market loss. Now, looking at FFO, FFO per share was $2.95. This is up about 1.4% year on year. And if you look at just the U.S. and domestic property NOI, that grew at 3.4% compared to last year. And their entire portfolio NOI was up about the same, but 3.6% year on year. Overall, I would say positive same store NOI performance. The FFO modestly beat analyst expectations, but ultimately EPS missed analyst expectations. And so that contributed to the stock falling about 5 to 6% after earnings. Also, there's increasing concern around the consumer picture. And so I think the slight miss was something that was viewed as, it was taken with a cautious, it played up that cautious tone, and ultimately shares fell. If you look at some of the operational highlights from across the portfolio over that first quarter, occupancy at U.S. malls and outlets rose to 95.9%. That's up 10 basis points from a year ago, which is a pretty solid occupancy level. And base minimum rents also climbed to $58.92 per square foot. That's up about 2.4% on a year-on-year basis. Now, retailer sales were healthy at $733 per square foot for a trailing 12-month period. which I think that's ultimately still a sign that if there is concern about a slowdown in consumer, at least Simon Property Group is not necessarily seeing that play out fully across their portfolio. They did note that they acquired two luxury outlet centers in Italy during the first quarter and then also opened a Jakarta Premium Outlets via JV in the first quarter. And that's something that I think playing up these kind of luxury international. I know that the global footprint is something that I think markets do appreciate. If you're playing out different scenarios that could result from or could inform potential outlooks given the shifting kind of trade environment, I do think that there is a benefit to having exposure outside of a single country. And so that is something that I believe the management team was playing up on the call. Some of the themes that stuck out during the call from the Q&A portion, Simon's leadership struck a balanced tone. They noted the strength of their business and called attention to the pretty solid financial and operating performance, but they also did address the macro headwinds. The management team did cite that the tariff uncertainties and retailer caution were on their watch list, and they were guiding 2025 results to be likely towards the middle of their FFO range. One thing that I would also call out is that they did reaffirm their 2025 guidance, even though they didn't adjust the numeric guidance. They were steering analysts to know that if the macro headwinds persist, that ultimately they'll land somewhere in the middle. They do expect cash flow to improve, though, as occupancy and rents continue to tick up. And they also noted that they're overall, quote, on track, unquote, with their plan to invest in redevelopment and mixed-use projects to drive their long-term growth. So that was coming from Simon, but you were tuned into to Kimco. What were you in here and there?
Yeah, so I think this is the first category of the ones that we've gone over where I think we looked at two very functionally different parts of the market. I think you could argue that Prologis and Rexford and Cousins and BXP are very much so in the same niche, but Simon and Kimco, very different companies. So Kimco is actually an open-air shopping center REIT. Most of their centers are grocery-anchored, and a lot of their tenants, and this is kind of the way they pitch it, cater to everyday needs retailing. So they have about 100 million square feet across 567 properties. They have properties in virtually every state, but they have heavy exposure to the larger states, Florida, California, Texas, which make up about 40% of their portfolio by square footage. More specifically, though, they focus on first-ring suburbs of major cities in those states. They have a clustering strategy. Now, their largest tenants are all familiar names, but I think, interestingly, they would not be ones you'd find at the mall or in some assignment centers. TJX, and mind you, this is in order of revenue. TJX, Home Depot, Walmart, Ross, Kroger, Albertsons, Burlington. So all kinds of big, large format names in retail. So they announced their results for Q1 on May 1st, and they beat consensus estimates on both revenue and FFO. Some interesting drivers behind their strong quarter, and they signed 583 leases totaling 4.4 million square feet. And this was a number that was unbelievable, but new lease spreads were 48.7%. That was the highest in over 7 years, so even exceeding pre-pandemic figures. Same-store NOI growth was 3.9% on the year. Small shop occupancy was up 20 basis points on the year to 91.7%. And they called out a couple of backfilling opportunities. So there were some major bankruptcies in the fourth quarter and in the first, but they have backfilled a significant number of Party City locations, 29 of the 49 that they had in their portfolio, at a 35% blended rent spread. They have backfilled 3 of 14 Big Lots locations. The bankruptcy was a little more recent, and most of those backfills for both Party City and Big Lots locations, they said some of them are going to grocery tenants, which I thought was super interesting. So repositioning those centers. So this stock reaction was very positive. They outperformed the kind of all REIT index by 4.4%. A lot of interesting management commentary on this call. They're targeting 100 to 150 million in dispositions for the rest of 2025, and they are going to directly redeploy that capital into existing assets in Florida and New York. Management did say that tariff-related uncertainty is a real thing, but it, for them, just introduced noise. They actually saw increases in foot traffic during the month of April, which they did talk about on the call, and that was 6%. They have two ground-up projects that they're working on that are in their development pipeline, a grocery-anchored center in Brownsville, Texas, and a full teardown redevelopment in Woodbridge, Virginia, which is an exurb of D.C., that's going to be anchored by a Home Depot. Despite a lot of the headlines of a lot of recent closures, bankruptcies for large retailers, in their own portfolio, they have seen lease expansions outperform closures, which I thought was super interesting. They did appear at REITweek, made a presentation. They focused a lot of their presentation on some of their scale advantages finally coming to fruition. I think we've called out on previous calls that they've made some big corporate acquisitions of Weingarten and RPT, and those have been fully incorporated into their portfolio. They're now delivering 9.9% growth in same center NOI, and they're fully self-funding this growth model. They have $145 million in annual free cash flow, which is something they called out at REITweek. Very different company than Simon, but a lot of good stuff there. It seems like Kimco is doing quite well carving out this niche of grocery anchored. So Omar, I think we got a couple of sectors left here. I'm going to go and jump in with multifamily. I think the two companies that we have covered, we've also covered in the past, and they're quite similar in kind of size, scale, and the type of tenant that they attract. But the one I listened to this time was Equity Residential. So one of the largest owners of apartments in the country, based in Chicago. They have around 85,000 units across a little over 300 properties. They're concentrated in coastal gateway markets. So New York, LA, Boston, San Francisco, Seattle, DC. But recently they've expanded into Denver, Atlanta, Dallas, Austin. And they specifically cater to long-term affluent renters in high barrier, high demand submarkets within those cities. They reported their results on April 30th. They missed consensus estimates on revenue, but they did beat on FFO. Some interesting drivers here. NOI was up 3% year on year. Rent growth was fairly modest though, 2.5% year on year. They had lower than expected growth in operating expenses, which is what drove some of that NOI increase. So 2.4% year on year. Occupancy was flat on the year at 96.3%. Lease renewal spreads at 5.2%. They said that Southern California and New York are showing relative overperformance, but Seattle and San Francisco continue to lag. Now, their renovations to existing units have produced upwards of double-digit increases in rent for them. Now, stock reaction, they just barely outperformed broader benchmark by 0.14%. Interesting management commentary on this call. They definitely are feeling the pressure from new supply deliveries in their core markets, particularly the ones that are in the Sun Belt. But they expect deliveries of similar product to theirs to peak over the summer. They said household formation continues to support demand, but they are seeing a lot of rent sensitivity on the margins for their more luxury product. Nonetheless, the rent versus buying gap is so large, and effectively buying is chronically out of reach, even for a lot of affluent folks in New York and LA, that this has been a big boon for them. They're looking at their financials. Their balance sheet's pretty conservative. They don't have any major debt maturities coming up. They're staggered far out into the future. But they do not plan any acquisitions or developments for the near future until they have more clarity on interest rates. Right now, they're planning some dispositions in their non-core markets. They didn't go into too much detail there, but they actually did present at REITweek as well. They did announce, actually, that they're going to be acquiring an 8-property Atlanta portfolio, so kind of went back on some of that plan. Maybe they got some more clarity on the interest rate environment after a month or two. And that portfolio is $535 million. It'll be funded through asset sales rather than debt. Now, they also backtracked on another kind of piece of commentary from the call that they're now seeing, even just after a few months into the year, some positive signs in San Francisco and Seattle, which are having some strong recovery trends. So kind of interesting call there. But now I know that you covered Avalon. These are very similar companies, so I'm curious to hear what they had to say.
Yeah, so Avalon reported a day after EQR, so on May 1st. And Avalon, as you mentioned, there are a lot of similarities there. They develop, redevelop, own and manage apartment communities with a primary focus on large MSAs or metros throughout the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and then West Coast. So they have both coasts. But then they also do have what they call their expansion regions, which are pretty much, if you just take the kind of hot cities over the last, I think, 5-6 years, whether it's in North Carolina, Florida, Texas, or Colorado.
That sounds very familiar.
Yeah. They own or have partial interest in about 309 communities, which account for about 95,000 units. And that's across the U.S. portfolio. One thing that is different, though, from EQR is they also have about 20 communities under development. So a bit more robust development pipeline. Turning attention to their first quarter results, they delivered, I would say, steady growth through Q1. So core FFO was $2.83 per share. That's up about 4.8% year on year. This is really driven by higher rental revenues. And if you look at the net income, it came in at about $1.66 per share. This is up 36% year on year, but that's due in a large part to gains on the sale of a community in Q1. In terms of real fundamentals or the real estate fundamentals, same store residential NOI rose 2.6% year on year in Q1. So very much modest growth, and there was some expense inflation, which was up 4% year on year and outpacing the revenue gains. Now, same store rental revenues increased 3%, even though expenses were growing at 4%, the same store rent growth at 3%, I think is pretty solid still. Their FFO did beat consensus by a small margin, or about 3 cents per share. This is Avalon Bay's third straight quarter of beating estimates, but I do think that they just barely beat estimates there. And shares were like barely reacted. They were down about 1% after the earnings, so very little reaction there. Turning a little bit more attention to their overall operating metrics, occupancy remained strong at about 95% across their portfolio. That is really in line with the same period in the prior year. And on the call, they noted that demand has really held up, even with elevated new apartment supply that we've seen really come online in many of their markets. Their blended growth rate for rent was in the low to mid single digits, and their retention of existing residents remains high, which is helping them limit their vacancy downtime. Now, one thing that I noted at the kind of top of this section is that they do have a pretty robust development pipeline. It's about $3 billion that is currently underway, which the management team says is going to really fuel their growth. And the deliveries of their pipeline are expected to be really phased over the next 2 years, so through 25 and into 27. Now, the management team did note that they're carefully watching the new apartment supply volumes, but so far, job growth and tenant demand remain solid enough to really absorb new units in most of their markets. The team also highlighted that the progress on developments and the recent community sale happened at a favorable price and are really reflective of kind of private market appetite for multifamily assets. The management team did reaffirm their full year 25 guidance, signaling confidence in its overall outlook. And the company maintained their prior 2025 core FFO guidance, which implies mid-single digit core FFO growth through the year. And their same store revenue and NOI growth targets remain to be in that about 4% range for revenue and about 3% growth range for NOI. For Q2 2025, they're expecting core FFO in the mid $2.70 per share range, and they are anticipating sequential improvement in same store revenue growth through the year, really as peak leasing season boosts rents. Now, one thing that they noted that they have some cautious optimism around is that apartment demand is currently resilient and should support steady rent growth through 2025, though growth will be more moderate than that post-pandemic surge. I think that's kind of a caveat that I'm sure a lot of investors and anybody watching the real estate markets and how much multifamily has been created in certain markets is very much aware of. But I think the management's attention to it really rings true with those folks. And I know we've gone through a lot here, but we also called out some of the kind of non-four core kind of property types. I'll take the first stab at one that I was listening to, which was Equinix, which I would say is a hot commodity now. They reported earnings on April 30th. Oh, and for those not familiar, this is one of the two data center specific REITs that's out there. They describe themselves as digital infrastructure, but I think otherwise they're often grouped in just data centers. They have about 270 properties covering about 24 million square feet. Overall, they had very robust Q1 performance and reported revenues of $2.2 billion. This is up 5% year on year on a reported basis and up about 8% on a normalized basis, excluding power cost pass-throughs. Ooh. Their adjusted EBITDA was $1.067 billion, representing about a 48% margin and an 8% year-on-year increase as operating leverage and high occupancy really continued to drive margin expansion. Net income jumped to $343 million for the first quarter. That's up about 48% year on year, with EPS of $3.50 per share, which was also up about 44% year on year. Now, if you look at their AFFO, so this is adjusted funds from operations, and this is Equinix's preferred key cash flow metric, this climbed to $947 million for the quarter. That's up 12% year on year. On a per share basis, AFFO was $9.67 per share, up about 9% year on year. Again, robust growth just across the board and really being propelled by strong demand for digital infrastructure and data center space. And I would say pretty successful pricing and cost management by the team. They handily beat expectations for Q1. Their AFFO per share, again, that's $9.67 per share, was roughly 6 to 7% above consensus. And revenue was also beating the estimate going into the call. They did raise their full year guidance across their key metrics and now project 2025 revenue to be $9.175 to $9.275 billion for the year. Or that would be representing about a 5 to 6% year on year growth rate. And they also raised their AFFO and, ultimately, they were just raising expectations across the board. Investors very much appreciated the results. Shares rose 2 to 3% after the call and then also in after hours trading. Now, some of the key drivers and trends that came out in the call is that demand for data center space and interconnection services really remains very robust and is experiencing a kind of a tailwind by enterprise cloud adoption. And it's a increasingly surging interest in overall AI workloads. The management team noted that, quote, strong demand for both AI and broader cloud services is really leading to higher bookings and an overall improving pipeline for the company. The company does have a global footprint, which they noted is really giving them a competitive moat as customers are continuing to consolidate their IT infrastructure, whether that's cross-border or moving domestically. And they also reported that interconnection revenue is growing at a double-digit pace. Now, occupancy rates at stabilized data centers are in the high mid to 80s to 90% range, which is really supporting their pricing power. They currently have 56 major projects underway across 33 metros in 24 countries to meet demand. Those numbers alone really speak to how they are continuing to develop. So the space and demand is growing, but that they very much have this kind of global footprint. Another thing that came out during the call is that they're well positioned to capture that AI specific demand. And they noted that NVIDIA chose the company. So NVIDIA chose Equinix to host its new instant AI factory as a managed service. And that is a pretty significant development and partnership. Now, while the call was a bit earlier, they did report at REIT Week. And I thought there were three main themes that I noted during their presentation that had to do with the overall kind of demand side. So first is that power constraints are really driving strategic shifts. And so the power constraints are fundamentally reshaping Equinix's strategy. The management highlighted that they're now pre-leasing retail facilities 9 to 12 months in advance. This is versus about 3 to 6 months in advance. And this is due to the power constraints in key metros. And I think that for Equinix, this will lead to more predictable revenue, but it also potentially signals this intensifying competition for sites that are able to be properly powered. Another main theme that came out is that the company is consolidating the development into fewer, larger builds rather than smaller modular construction. And this should potentially improve the capital efficiency and better serve the kind of growing enterprise power needs. And then the final piece that they noted is that inference is taking preference over training, which I think this has potentially very significant long-term implications. But the management team emphasized that AI development is really shifting towards this distributed inference rather than this massive centralized training facilities. So those are some of the main themes coming out of Equinix's results, their recent presentation at REIT Week, and I think broad implications on an exciting data center space. But Cole, I know in terms of other REITs, I know you were paying attention to another hot space, which was healthcare and seniors. And who were you listening to?
And this has been one of the kind of best performers in the market over the last few months, or really over the last year, but I was paying attention to Welltower. So I have fairly short comments about this, but this is a super interesting call. For those who don't know, Welltower is an Ohio-based healthcare REIT, but they have a diversified portfolio of senior housing, skilled nursing, medical office, outpatient facilities, and they have 2,100 properties. They operate within the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. In the U.S. alone, they have more than 100 million square feet. And their largest markets are Dallas, New York, LA, Philly, Houston. So some of the largest cities in the U.S. They announced their results on April 29th, and they delivered a solid beat across every metric except for top line revenue, which I'm burying the lead a little bit there because revenue was up 30% year on year. So they just didn't meet consensus expectations. But there were some some key drivers here across at least, and I'll separate this by senior housing and their outpatient medical and health system portfolio, which is how they separate it. Same store NOI for senior housing grew 13.4% year on year. Occupancy was 83.7%. That was up 80 basis points on the quarter and 310 basis points on the year. And rent growth was 6.5% on the year. Now for outpatient medical and health system, again, this is an interesting metric here because a lot of the stuff that's lumped in here is sale leasebacks of hospitals. So it's hard to gauge what occupancy might mean in a traditional kind of CRE sense. But some of their other facilities that are lumped in here, they've stated that they have a 97% occupancy rate. They saw steady NOI growth of 2-3%. And they're actually now proposing about $1.5 billion in acquisitions. So the market reacted very positively to this call. The All-REIT, they outperformed the All-REIT benchmark by almost 2 percentage points. Some really interesting commentary here, and I think this is one of the most important things that's really driving their performance, that they believe 2025 marks a demographic inflection point for them. The 80-plus population in the U.S., they expect to grow at about 4% annually. And they expect 5 or more years of above-trend demand for senior living. And the demand has materially outstripped deliveries over the last few years. They say that senior housing starts, according to their metrics, are down 30% from pre-pandemic levels. And so they really think that this is going to drive occupancy in some of their existing portfolio. They have a pretty healthy balance sheet, $2.5 billion in liquidity. Majority of their debt is fixed rate. They have no significant maturities in 2025. So overall, markets seem to really like this call. And it's no surprise that a lot of the future is being priced in here for Welltower. Definitely one that I'll take a listen to next time we go through these. So Omar, do you have any overall takeaway from the ones that you listened to?
Yeah, if anybody has listened all the way to the end of this, I give you props. You're an endurance athlete. I would say that overall, still pretty strong performance across at least these select REITs. And a key takeaway I've had, because a lot of these were coming out during kind of tariff turmoil and sentiment swung from pretty positive for the year ahead to just confused to negative, I think that one of the key takeaways is that sentiment can swing faster than contracts can be rewritten. And that is something that I think we can see that coming out with this performance, and good management and good operators still can deliver good results.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the other thing that's super interesting is I think oftentimes the REITs are lumped in together as one kind of interest rate sensitive blob, but these are 10 plus companies we just covered here that are totally different niches that cover completely different types of properties and have totally different demand drivers. So I think philosophically, it's interesting to think about it that way. But you're right. A lot of the calls that we covered, I think the tariff turmoil was treated as noise instead of something super tangible just yet. I think some of that's timing, but we'll have to wait and see. The second quarter results could be really interesting, but we already know from some of the comments from REIT Week that things seem to be chugging along for a few of these.
Yeah.
So I can't wait to hear some of those second quarter results. But so Omar, I do think that's all the time we have today. Before we sign off, I just want to encourage listeners again, if you like the show, we would love it if you could rate it, give us 5 stars on your preferred podcast platform, leave us a comment. We'd love to read them. But we're also responsive via email. We have altusresearch@altusgroup.com. We would love to know what topics you'd like covered on the program. But in the meantime, Omar, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of CRE Exchange. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast, powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more altusgroup.com.